you for the invitation, it's been really nice to be here. Yeah, so the motivation for your project is basically that we have this, we now have this very rich and interesting literature on mathematical features and contextuality.
Yeah, we have this very rich mathematical literature on contextuality, and what I wanted to do in this project was sort of try to bring as much of that together as possible and try to answer some high-level questions around sort of why should we care about contextuality and what is it telling us about reality. So I'll be brief about the definitions because I'm sure everyone here knows what contextuality is, and I'll try to move on to the conclusions, which will be hopefully more interesting. There are a couple of new mathematical results in this paper, but I'm not going to focus on them too much because I'm more interested in kind of presenting some conclusions and also hearing what you guys think about the same questions. So I will discuss some ideas that are raised in the literature about what exactly is the problem with contextuality, and I will ultimately argue that, in my opinion, the most perspicacious way to think about contextuality is as a fine-tuning problem. I'll then ask, if it is a fine-tuning problem, how might we go about explaining that fine-tuning? And then finally, if time, I will comment on some other interesting frameworks that have been used for understanding contextuality and try to understand what conclusions we might draw from those frameworks. So as you all know, the sort of original idea of contextuality came from this notion that measurement outcomes should be in a one-to-one relationship with sort of definite properties of systems. So we can think of measurements as kind of asking a question of the form, which one of these properties do you currently have? So if that's how you think of measurements, then you would naturally expect that given a set of possible measurements and measurement outcomes, we should be able to assign the values 1 and 0 to all of the outcomes such that every possible measurement has exactly one outcome with value 1. And that's that's supposed to be the property that the system definitely has and the value that will definitely occur. So obviously, if every outcome occurs in only one measurement, that will always be possible. But for quantum systems of dimension greater than 2, outcomes occur in more than one measurement. And it has been shown in the Cochen-Specker theorem that there exist sets of quantum measurements where we can't achieve this mapping from outcomes to 1 and 0. So what that means is that we can't sort of interpret measurement outcomes in this naive way as being associated in a one-to-one way with elements of reality or properties. And some people have concluded from that in some sense the Cochen-Specker theorem disproves realism or something like that. I think that's obviously not right. All the Cochen-Specker theorem is telling us is that we have to take a slightly less naive view about the mathematical structure, and we have to interpret it in a less literal way. So one might then ask, if we're not going to interpret the maths in this less literal way, what happens to the notion of contextuality? Rob came along and showed us that, in fact, there is still a notion of contextuality which can be applied even in a context where we don't assume that measurements stand in a one-to-one measurement outcomes stand in a one-to-one relationship with definite properties. So he used the ontological models framework, and he defined preparation on contextuality by saying that an ontological model is preparation non-contextual if all preparations that prepare the same quantum state are represented by the same probability distribution in the underlying ontological model. And similarly, measurement non-contextuality is defined such that an ontological model is measurement non-contextual if a quantum mechanical measurement operator is always represented by the same response function. And Rob then showed that quantum mechanics can't be represented by a preparation non-contextual ontological model. It can technically be represented by a measurement non-contextual model, although under some plausible conditions that you might want the model to have, you then also end up ruling out measurement non-contextuality. So what this result shows, I think, is that contextuality is not just sort of a failing that arises from taking the math too literally. It does sort of seem to be really present there in the empirical results. It's a sort of real feature in the world in the way that one might think Cochen-Specker contextuality is not. So the question I then want to ask is, you know, why should we care about this feature, and what is this feature of quantum mechanics telling us? So there are various sort of things that have been raised in the literature in connection with what is wrong with contextuality. So in some cases, what's been discussed is Leibniz's principle. My cat is called Leibniz, so that's the reason for the photo. So Leibniz's principle appears in a variety of different forms throughout history. The version of it which is relevant in this case is, I think, the version which says something like, if two things are empirically indistinguishable, then we should try to avoid scientific theories which tell us that they are numerically distinct. So I think the problem with this use of Leibniz's principle is that we're not really dealing with anything that could possibly be numerically identical. So in Leibniz's original application, he famously applied this to absolute space. He looked at, he was considering the example of a whole world being shifted by 5 meters. And he noted that Newtonian theory with absolute space said that these two possibilities were different. They represented different possible worlds. And he argued that we should therefore move to a theory which says that they are the same possible world. They're one and the same thing. A contextuality case isn't really like that because in the case of contextuality, if, say, you and I both prepare the same quantum state using different preparations, there's no entity which could possibly be present in both of those cases. Those are two different events involving different systems, different people. So there's not anything that could be numerically identical across those two cases. At best, what could happen is that we could end up preparing two systems which happen to have the same state. But states are not entities, so states can't really be regarded as having numerical identity or not. So I don't think that Leibniz's principle is really a good way of capturing exactly what's going on there. By using the word numerical, I'm trying to distinguish between numerical identity and qualitative identity, where numerical identity refers to things being one and the same thing, whereas qualitative identity refers to things being different things but having similar qualities or being similar. So in the contextuality case, we have two systems which are similar in certain ways because they might possibly have the same ontic state, but they couldn't possibly be numerically identical. They couldn't be one and the same thing. And so all of the other applications of Leibniz's principle I know about deal with numerical identity and not qualitative identity. Similarly, Leibniz's principle also usually is applied to cases where there is perfect indistinguishability, where there's nothing at all which could possibly tell the cases apart, like in the shifted world case. There's no observation at all that distinguishes those. Whereas in the contextuality case, obviously they're not perfectly indistinguishable. They are different preparations performed by different people using different methods. So the claim is not that they are totally indistinguishable, but that the differences between them are not relevant in some way. And Leibniz's principle can't really tell us about which differences are or are not relevant because it describes only cases where everything is indistinguishable. And finally, I think that even if contextuality were a violation of Leibniz's principle, that's not really a very useful way of thinking about it because if all we could say would just be, well, I guess so much the worse for Leibniz's principle. Clearly it was wrong, we should throw it away. So that doesn't really tell us what to do about contextuality or how to explain it. And as we'll shortly see, I think there are more useful ways of thinking about what's wrong with it. It's also common to talk about contextuality with reference to Einstein, and in particular, this iconic line with which he opens his 1905 paper, where he says, we should try to get rid of asymmetries which do not appear to be inherent in the phenomena. So Einstein there is also talking about absolute space and observing that absolute space gives rise to makes us regard as distinct situations which we don't necessarily need to regard as distinct. So he's basically invoking Occam's razor and saying we don't need this distinction. It's not doing any work in the theory. Let's get rid of it. So that's different to the contextuality case because kind of the point of the contextuality theorems is that contextuality is inherent in the phenomena and we can't just remove it. So if this were really just about Occam's razor and about trying to remove asymmetries that are not needed, one would think that Rob's contextuality proofs would have been the end of the story. Evidently, this asymmetry is inherent in the phenomena. No one needs to worry about it anymore. But again, that's not what happened. We still seem to think contextuality is interesting and worth studying. So I think that's an acknowledgement of the fact that there's something more going on here. And again, in this case, if we were to say this is just an example of the Einstein-like reasoning, there wouldn't really be much we could do about that because we can't follow Einstein's advice and get rid of the asymmetry in this case, so it would be kind of a dead end, that line of reasoning.
Explain again what you mean by inherent in the phenomena?
Inherent in the phenomena, in Einstein's case, he's saying that absolute space doesn't appear to be inherent in the phenomena because we can give an empirically we can give an equally good model which has all the same empirical predictions that doesn't use that distinction. So it's kind of an extra thing that we've put in the way we've written down the theory, but it's not really there in the world. So I take the contextuality theorems as proving that contextuality in some sense really there is there in the world and can't just be gotten rid of in that way. So to see what is wrong with contextuality, I think it's helpful to stop and imagine what a non-contextual model might look like. So one way to kind of try to arrive at a non-contextual model would be to change the way that we think about measurement. So instead of thinking of a measurement as asking a question like, which one of these properties do you currently have? The measurement would ask a question like, which one of these options do you prefer? So in that kind of context, it's very straightforward to see why whether or not I get a certain measurement outcome should depend on what the other possible outcomes were. So if for example, you prefer bacon to eggs and you prefer eggs to toast, if I offer you bacon and eggs, you will choose bacon. If I offer you bacon and toast, you will if I offer you eggs and toast, you will choose eggs. So whether or not you choose eggs depends on what the other options were. And some time ago, Rudolph suggested a model of this kind that he called that marble world. The idea was that the state is like a marble which rolls around on the surface of a sphere, and the measurement outcomes are vectors. And basically, when you perform a measurement, the state is attracted to the closest measurement outcome, whatever that might be. So in that kind of setting, it's very natural that whether or not you get a certain measurement outcome should depend on what the other possible outcomes are. So in that case, measurement contextuality seems very natural, and one might start to wonder, you know, why anyone would ever have thought it was a problem. But there is a good reason to think it's a problem, and that reason is what I'll refer to as Gleason's property, which is the fact that, obviously, in quantum mechanics, you can see very clearly from the way in which we calculate probabilities that for a given state, the probability of obtaining a given measurement outcome is always the same regardless of which measurement we're performing. So that is to say, although there is dependence at some level, contextuality shows us between what outcome, whether or not we get a certain outcome and what the other possible outcomes are, that dependence never shows up in the statistics. So if you want to try and create a preference model, preference ordering style model of measurement and make it respect Gleason's property, you have to very carefully adjust all the parameters of your model to make sure that those dependencies exactly cancel out when you try to average over ontic states. Which is to say, if you want to make that kind of model, you have to fine tune it. So basically, that is the correct way of thinking about what is going wrong with contextuality. It's this mismatch between the statistics and Gleason's property, having Gleason's property and the underlying dependence, which means that any model that reproduces it has to be fine-tuned. And Cavalcanti has a really nice paper showing that indeed measurement contextuality of the Cochin-Spicker kind necessarily always corresponds to a fine-tuned causal model. So there he takes as his variables. One variable is whether or not I get a certain measurement outcome, and another variable is what the other possible outcomes are. And he observes that since we have probabilistic independence between those variables, but we know from the contextuality theorems that there must be some connections between them in the causal diagram, that is a case of fine-tuning. And you might well wonder if preparation contextuality is also a case of fine-tuning, and indeed I think it is, and I use a proof very similar to this one in this paper to show that in that case the variables in question are what preparation you used and what the results of your subsequent measurements are. So again, from preparation contextuality, we know there are causal connections there, but because they all prepare the same quantum state, there's a probabilistic independence. So once again, that's a case of fine-tuning. I like this account partly because it allows us to unify contextuality with the signaling and non-locality, because of course, Cavalcanti's proof was inspired by Rob's very nice proof showing that if you want to combine non-locality with non-signaling, you have to have a fine-tuned causal model to do that. So this way of thinking about it, I think, allows us to see all of these phenomena as manifestations of the same kind of underlying problem. And I also like this because if this is a fine-tuning issue, that kind of gives us somewhere to go, because if this is fine-tuned, we can then ask, where does the fine-tuning come from? How can that fine-tuning be explained? So I will, in a minute, begin talking about how we might explain that fine-tuning, but I want to briefly pause and talk about, try to understand in slightly more detail the nature of the fine-tuning that's present in the preparation contextuality case. So I don't know, maybe this is really obvious to everyone already, but this was helpful for me to understand what's going on. So let's deal just with the outcome deterministic case. And in that case, obviously, we can think of each ontic state as just being a list of all the outcomes that you would get for all of the possible measurements you could perform. So therefore, every possible preparation procedure can be understood as defining a probability distribution over these lists, which I'll refer to as the counterfactual outcomes. So I'll say that the distribution associated with some preparation is unbiased if the distributions over each entry in the list are marginally independent of the other distributions. And otherwise, I'll say it's biased. So basically, the distribution is biased if the probability that I would have got this outcome when I did measurement one is not independent of the probability that I would have got some other outcome when I did measurements two and three. So one might think, for example, that if we're preparing, say, the maximally mixed state, those distributions might be unbiased. But in fact, it turns out that they are not in general unbiased, and moreover, different probabilistic decompositions will lead to different kinds of biases. So to see that, have a look at this example here. Let's write our counterfactual outcomes so that the first three entries in it are equal to the outcomes for M1, M2, and M3, as shown here. And I'll just label those at 0 and 1 in the order that they appear. So then looking at the preparation procedures that can be associated with these three states on the right. Evidently, the preparation procedure associated with P1 must end up assigning probability 0 to all counterfactual outcomes whose first entry is 1. P2 must assign probability 0 to all counterfactual outcomes whose second entry is 1. And P3 must assign probability 0 to all counterfactual outcomes whose third entry is 1. So now, if I prepare the maximally mixed state by an equal mixture of P1, P2, and P3, obviously, because it's the maximally mixed state, the probability of getting outcome 1 to any one of these three measurements has got to be half. But if we assume that the composition occurs in the usual sort of convex combination way, it's clear that there's not going to be any possible way to obtain a counterfactual outcome where we're certain to get the result 1 to all of those measurements. So the probability of getting a counterfactual outcome whose first three entries are 1, 1, 1 has to be 0. That is to say that distribution is biased. The probability of getting the probability that the first outcome is equal to 1, given that the second two outcomes are equal to 1, has to be 0. And moreover, different probabilistic decompositions of the maximally mixed state won't have that feature. They'll have different kinds of biases. And you can sort of show this more formally by going through Rob's original proof of preparation contextuality and just kind of rewriting the whole thing in terms of counterfactual outcomes. And what you'll see is that although these distributions all give rise to the same probability distribution for any one measurement outcome, they will have these different biases. They will have different relationships between what you would have got if you could have performed more than one measurement. So obviously, quantum mechanics doesn't allow us to perform one measurement, so all that information in the biases is kind of hidden from us. So that makes the fine-tuning question, I think, a little bit more precise. The question is, why do we have these cases where all the differences between the distributions is hidden in these counterfactual outcomes that are inaccessible to us, and we can never kind of detect these differences by means of a single measurement? Okay, so the question then is, if we accept that this is all a kind of a fine-tuning problem, what options do we have to explain the fine-tuning? So I want to pause here and reinforce that these kinds of fine-tuning arguments, so the contextuality ones and also Rob's original no-signaling one, are different from the kinds of fine-tuning arguments that sometimes appear elsewhere in physics regarding things like the cosmological constant. So the difference is that those cosmological constant type arguments are very theory dependent. They're observing that there's some mismatch between a theoretical prediction and reality. So there's always an option to respond to those by saying, well, obviously there was some problem with the theory. Whereas these types of fine-tuning arguments made using the causal modeling framework are deliberately very theory independent. The point of using the causal modeling framework is precisely not to invoke any particular theoretical assumptions or structures other than the assumption that there's a causal explanation. So these types of fine-tuning arguments, I think, really do reflect something that is directly there in the data and is not just a mismatch between the theory and the prediction. I think it's worth saying because the fine-tuning arguments used in cosmology and particle physics have been criticized a lot in recent years, and I think many of those criticisms are very valid, but I don't think that they apply to this kind of argument. So what are the options for explaining this kind of fine-tuning? Obviously, one option is just to say that it doesn't need explaining and we'll just accept it. And that's kind of what some early approaches to superdeterminism do, although the superdeterminism people are very anxious for me to tell you that their more recent versions don't do this. So I haven't decided whether or not that's true, but that's what they say. Another option is, of course, to deny that there is any reality underlying quantum mechanics, in which case there's no possibility of having any kind of causal model, and therefore there's no possibility of a mismatch between the causal model and the statistics. So obviously anti-realism is always an option. I don't find it very interesting or useful, so I won't pursue it further. So what if we are realists and we do want to explain the fine-tuning? I can think of two possible routes that we might pursue. So one of them is the one that is often advocated in the literature on causal modeling, and that's to propose some kind of equilibration explanation. So by equilibration, I mean propose some kind of dynamical mechanism such that you can start out with an arbitrary non-fine tuned distribution, and over time you will kind of approach the desired fine-tuned distribution. And that's more or less what some versions of the de Broglie-Bohm model do. So the de Broglie-Bohm people have argued that if you start up with your de Broglie-Bohm particles in some random distribution, then for most of such possible initial distributions, over time, if they evolve according to the usual de Broglie-Bohm dynamical equation, they will move closer and closer to the special quantum distribution that's required to reproduce the quantum statistics. So that in some ways I think is quite nice. I think it's perhaps not reinforced enough that de Broglie-Bohm is, as far as I can tell, the only one of the mainstream interpretations that does have some kind of response to this fine-tuning problem. I do worry a little bit that response just looks a bit like it's shifting the whole problem into the dynamical equations and still not really explaining it. It also has the feature that if that's the way you think things work, it follows that in the very early universe, before the dynamical process had occurred, we should expect that the fine-tuned features didn't hold, so we should expect to see superluminal signaling. We should expect to see violations of Gleason's property. That looks a bit worrying. There's potentially some pathological consequences of that. So one might perhaps wonder if there's an explanation which can give us these fine-tuned features in a universal way. So obviously, kind of by definition, an explanation that says these features hold universally can't really be a causal explanation. So if your sort of notion of realism is very strongly tied to causal explanations, you might worry that kind of looks like a dead end. But I think there are various assumptions that go into the causal modeling framework that we might consider dropping before abandoning realism entirely. So in particular, the causal modeling framework, because it's dealing with causal relations, which are supposed to be asymmetric, requires us to assume that all of the events and the variables in the causal diagram are related by an acyclic graph. So one natural way to respond to this, I think, would be perhaps to drop the acyclic assumption and allow that things could be related by asymmetric reciprocal relations. There are sort of good reasons from other areas of physics to think anyway that causation might not be a fundamental feature of reality, and that perhaps we should be moving to something a bit more symmetric and reciprocal. So I've spoken to some people who kind of think we should go up to here and then stop. We should just say quantum mechanics doesn't have a causal explanation, therefore there's no fine-tuning problem, end of story, we can forget about contextuality. I don't find that very satisfactory because even if we're not going to give causal explanations, that doesn't mean anything goes. There are still obviously some restrictions on what can and can't happen. So if we don't have causal restrictions, we still need to know what are the restrictions on these symmetric relations and why do they give us the specific bounds that they do? Why can't I send signals using these relations? Why can't I violate Gleason's property? So because in this kind of picture, we no longer have events in our causal diagram being generated in some specific order, It becomes natural, I think, to imagine these events being generated in a sort of all at once way. So there's some distribution over all of the events, which just determines the whole distribution at once in an atemporal way. And that gives rise to new possibilities for explanation, because we can adopt what I refer to as a teleological explanation, where we apply some constraint to the whole distribution all at once and allow the relevant fine-tuned parameters to be generated as outputs rather than as inputs. So for example, in the contextuality case, we could just apply Gleason's property directly as a constraint to the whole distribution. And then obviously the parameters will have to be adjusted in such a way as to give the apparently fine-tuned effects. Now you might well think that's too easy. Obviously we don't want to make explanation too cheap because then it will just lose all its heuristic value. So ideally we'd like to have, if we're going to go down this teleological route, we probably want to arrive at some kind of deeper reason why these constraints should hold. And there is actually, sorry.
Yes. I don't know if you mind taking questions.
No, go ahead, yeah.
So there's a question by Yile.
Yes.
She's asking, how about the third realist option where we use quantum causal models instead of the classical ones used by Kevin?
Yes, my list of realist options was not intended to be exhaustive, so I'm very open to other explanations. I'm just going to talk about the two that I've thought about and deeply, but we can certainly discuss other ones afterwards if you're looking to do that. Right, yes, so there is a very good reason why Gleason's property should hold. And it's because if Gleason's property didn't hold, we would be able to use quantum processes to send signals backwards in time. So to see that, suppose we have two measurements, one with outcomes A, B, and C, and another one with outcomes A, D, and E, such that the probability for obtaining a positive result to this measurement A, obtaining the outcome A, is different in the two contexts. So we can always split these measurements up into parts where we first measure A or not A, and then later on we measure either B, C, or D, E. So if Gleason's property is violated here, it follows that the result of our first measurement, A or not A, has to depend on whether we later measure B, C, or D, E. So that would constitute a signal being sent backwards in time. Now, I think it's kind of intuitively clear that sending signals backwards in time is going to be a bit problematic and lead to some pathologies. But let's try to be slightly more precise. So, yes?
Sorry, so here, if you can measure A alone and then later choose if you're going to measure B, C, or D,
yeah,
then isn't your context just A? Like?
Yeah, so the problem is that if it were the case that that there's a different probability of getting the result A in these two different measurements, what then is going to happen when I measure A on its own? So there has to be some probability distribution there. So either it's not the case that it depends on the context, or it does depend on the context, in which case it seems to depend on my later choice of which context to measure. Yes.
So if you model measurements in say, the De Broglie-Bohm model,
mm-hmm.
A paper where I did this for some interferometric setups, we have these kind of things, then you can be in a situation exactly like this, where you first bring out one projection operator.
Yeah.
Later you decide. In that case, it wouldn't be contextual, it wouldn't depend on what you did later.
Yeah.
Whereas if you set up your interferometer the other way around,
mm-hmm.
afterwards, then it would be contextual. So the model would have more structure so that the order in which you make these measurements would matter. And of course, the only way you get the Copeland spectrum, whichever proof you want, over a big set of outcomes. It doesn't follow from Copeland spectrum, for example, that any given measurement has to be contextual. It's sort of only one of a set of different measurements has to be contextual. So it might not be the particular one you picked out in this case, for example.
Yes. So I'm looking here not at the contextuality part, but just at Gleason's property.
Okay.
So the concern is if the observable probability for A is different in these two contexts, then you have a signaling effect. So I'm not discussing the underlying reality at this stage.
Okay, I guess I'm saying that it might be that the underlying probability is different in some cases for the experimental arrangement, but not in the cases that drive this theorem up. So.
Yeah. Yes. I guess one possible way to get around this would be to say that we have differences in probabilities if you perform all the measurements at once, and not if you split them up in this way.
And that's exactly what would happen in the De Broglie-Bohm model with non-equilibrium distributions going in.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's how it would work in De Broglie-Bohm. So what would be wrong with this possibility of being able to send a signal by if my earlier measurement on A or not A depended on my later decision B, C, or D, E? So one potential problem that could arise is what the philosophers refer to as bilking. So that's referring to cases like the grandfather paradox, where a time traveler goes back in time and kills his own grandfather before the grandfather can procreate. So then the time traveler, of course, is not born, and a logical paradox ensues. So it's easy to see how you could arrange the same kind of problematic scenario if you could send signals back in time. For example, I could send a message to my future self containing the value of some bit. My future self could then flip that bit and send that backwards in time, and it would arrive just in time for me to use it as the content of my original message. So that message would then have two different bit values at once, which seems like a contradiction. So in the Gleason's property case, it's not quite so straightforward to make that argument, because typically we're dealing with probabilistic stuff rather than deterministic things. And with probabilistic processes, you'll never arrive at an outright contradiction like that. What you will get is that if Gleason's property could be violated in this way, then when you made compositions, loop-like compositions of this form, basically you would have to observe that the probability distribution observed when things are composed into loops is different from the distribution that's observed when they're not composed into loops. So there would seem to be a sense in which the process would need to know global facts about the way in which it was composed before being able to decide its outcome. So that, if not logically paradoxical, certainly seems a little bit paradox adjacent, or at least forcing us to question some of the ontological assumptions that we make. Another way to see what's wrong with these types of processes is to observe that they have to be non-deterministic in a really radical type of way. So this is a little bit like the science fiction story where a mysterious stranger gives you the designs for a time machine, and then you build the time machine and you go back in time to give yourself the designs. So those designs have just kind of popped out of nowhere. They can't have any cause outside this loop that you've created. And so they're indeterministic in a really radical way. And similarly, if I could make these kind of loop-like constructions using violations of Gleason's theorem, there would be values inside that loop which would be totally undetermined. And so if you think that there should be some kind of determinism at some level in the universe, that you have good reason to think these kinds of loops shouldn't be allowed. So I think the nice thing about this way of explaining measurement contextuality is that it allows us to make a link with the no signaling case. Because obviously, if I could send superluminal signals, I could again create the same kind of loops, right? I could send a bit value to Bob. Bob could switch the bit value and then send it back to me, and I would receive it and just in time to use it as the content of my original message. So if you agree there's something problematic about these kinds of closed loops, then you think that there should be a constraint ruling them out, that constraint will give you both no signaling and also measurement contextuality. So it will explain kind of both of these fine-tuned phenomena. And so you might well ask, can preparation contextuality also be explained in the same way? And I think it can if you're also willing to use the Choi-Jamiolkowski isomorphism. So the Choi-Jamiolkowski isomorphism is a mathematical relationship which shows us that in operational terms, for every scenario where we perform measurements on two entangled states, there's a corresponding scenario where we choose some preparation and then perform a measurement on the result of that preparation. And the statistics will exactly match between these two cases. What that means is that if it were possible to use what that means is that if we have two entangled states, it follows from no signaling that it must be impossible to tell by measurements on the one side what measurements you chose to perform on the other side. So transforming that into the prepare measure case, what that means is that it must be impossible. There must be scenarios where it's impossible to tell by your final measurement what preparation you chose, because preparations correspond to measurements in this transformation. So if you accept the Choi-Jamiolkowski isomorphism as sufficiently basic, it follows that the preparation contextuality case follows directly from the no signaling case. And so the same kind of loop-like explanation essentially rules out preparation contextuality, essentially explains preparation contextuality as well. So I I'm not necessarily claiming that this sort of prohibition on closed loops is, you know, the one is necessarily the correct explanation for all this, but I do find it personally quite compelling. And I also think it's a nice example of what this kind of teleological reasoning might look like and the ways in which it provides us with new sorts of explanatory strategies. Okay, I will briefly talk now about a couple of other mathematical approaches to contextuality and try to make some comments on what conclusions we can draw from them. So one very nice approach to contextuality is this quantum logic approach, where we basically treat measurement outcomes as Boolean variables and then derive from classical logic an upper bound on the sums of probabilities for various sets of measurement outcomes. And it can be shown that both non-local and Cochin-Spicker correlations violate these inequalities. So I think there's kind of two natural ways of understanding these results. One of them is to say that classical logic doesn't work in the quantum world. There's some kind of special quantum logic which is different from classical logic. And, you know, various people over the history of quantum mechanics have really advocated that. And the other possibility is to say that measurement outcomes are not the set kind of thing which is appropriate to describe as Boolean variables. So this kind of goes back to the preference ordering model of measurement that I discussed earlier. So in this case where, say, I offer you a bunch of different breakfast items every morning and I ask you to choose exactly one, if I were to write down your choices and try to treat them as Boolean variables and try to put them into logical inequalities, I would probably find that those Boolean variables would not obey logical inequalities because, of course, your choice of which breakfast item to consume depends on what other options I've presented to you. Those two options, either classical logic doesn't work or measurement outcomes are like breakfast objects. You know, no one would be tempted to postulate a kind of special non-classical breakfast logic to explain that. And again, if we don't think of quantum measurement outcomes as Boolean variables, we don't need a different quantum logic. We just need to say that classical logic doesn't apply in this particular case. I personally prefer the second version just because I think the first version doesn't really seem very explanatory. To me, exactly what needs explaining in this case is precisely the fact that classical logic doesn't seem to work. And so simply saying that classical logic doesn't work doesn't really answer the questions that we have there. So I prefer to take an approach which accept that measurement outcomes are not to be described as Boolean variables and tries to explain why that is. There are also very, very many different approaches to contextuality which observe that contextuality disappears if we allow some kind of non-classical probabilities. So negative probabilities or complex probabilities or relax one of these various assumptions that are normally placed on classical probability spaces. So again, we kind of have the same two options. Either we can say that quantum mechanics literally exhibits negative probabilities in some sense, or we can say there's something about the structure of quantum mechanics which makes it appropriate to use negative probabilities in our mathematical descriptions sometimes, even though there are not literally negative probabilities in the real world. I think the problem with the first of these two options is that it's really hard to see how negative probabilities could be literally probabilities in any sense. It's normal to in philosophy to distinguish between sort of two models of probability: the subjective probabilities which describe our degrees of belief, and objective probabilities which are supposed to describe something that's really out there in the world. So the problem with saying that negative probabilities or any of these other non-classical probabilities are subjective probabilities is that it can be shown, and Feinzig and Fletcher do this in this very nice paper, that any such non-classical probabilities, if adopted as subjective probabilities, will lead agents to behave in paradigmatically irrational ways. In particular, it can be shown that they will accept a bet which is guaranteed to lose. So it seems hard to argue that any rational agents could consider these types of things to be their subjective probabilities. So what about objective probabilities? The problem here is that we don't have a very good understanding of what objective probabilities are, but the one thing that most people agree on is that objective probabilities should obey the principal principle, which says that an agent who knows these objective probabilities should set their subjective probabilities equal to them. And we've just seen that rational agents can't set their subjective probabilities equal to negative or complex or any of these other kinds of probabilities. So it doesn't seem obvious how these probabilities could be objective probabilities either. So for that reason, I again prefer the option which says, you know, whatever probabilities are involved with quantum mechanics are really just, you know, normal classical probabilities, but there's something about the structure of the theory which makes it appropriate to use negative probabilities somewhere. I give an example of a paper of one possible way of doing that. And that involves basically taking a contextual model, a totally classical, standard, but contextual model of quantum mechanics, and compressing it to a model defined on fewer ontic states. That's always possible with a contextual model because if in the case where two different measurement outcomes have the same probability on all of the states, it follows that all of the states must be orthogonal to the difference between those two measurement outcomes, and therefore they will always live on a smaller subspace of the ontic state space, and therefore you can define a compression procedure which takes your state down to a smaller number of ontic states, and thus remove some of the contextuality. And if you do that successively many times for every different case of contextuality you have in your theory, eventually you will arrive at a non-contextual theory. But of course, the problem is that this compression procedure will typically introduce negative probabilities because you won't be able to, in general, map all of your preparation procedures and ontic states into the non-negative orthant of the smaller state space. So this is just an example, but it's just meant to show that we don't have to think of the negative probabilities as being literal because we can understand them as just being produced in this kind of compression procedure if we try to arrive at a theory which has no contextuality. There are many other interesting approaches to contextuality, which I discussed some of these briefly, but I don't think I have anything all that exciting to say about them. But here they are for reference if anyone is interested in more contextuality stuff. And that's pretty much all I had to say, so maybe we should stop and have some questions, discussion.
I don't know how this is supposed to work. I'm sharing.
I'd like to talk a lot. I just wanted to, this part about closed loops.
Yeah.
No closed loops. Mm-hmm. So you weren't claiming that, you know, if you forbid closed loops, you can kind of derive contextuality, but more that you can explain contextuality in the sense by this general,
What you derive specifically is Gleason's property. So the idea is that you start with a general model which is allowed to be as contextual as you like, but evidently it has to obey Gleason's property. Why is that? Well, because the claim is that it's because of this constraint that's imposed on the whole distribution that requires that everything is fine-tuned to meet Gleason's property.
So Gleason's property says that if I have measurement 1 and measurement 2 which share outcome A, then the probability of obtaining outcome A has to be independent of measurement 1 and measurement 2.
Yes.
Right. And you're saying that if you violated this, then you could signal the path, for instance, via measurement choices or something like that.
Yeah, assuming as we said that the probabilities don't change if you sort of split the measurement up in this way.
Okay. So at one point you said something about it. So you've got this very weird thing in quantum mechanics that you have these counterfactual outcomes which have to differ, mm-hmm. even though we can't ever probe them.
Yeah.
But I would say that we can probe them. So, you know, if you do a preparation, there's this like flag variable. So mm-hmm. somewhere in the universe there is this information about which preparation choice was made.
Yeah.
So in a way, I could probe it, right, if I had access to all the photons bouncing off the laboratory equipment.
So you definitely know, in terms of, if you know what preparation was performed, you can then figure out what the counterfactual outcome must have looked like. I guess the question is, why is that information hidden if you just look at the system itself? Because in some sense, that information must be kind of stored in the system because it has to give the right counterfactual outcomes, but nonetheless, that is totally inaccessible.
Given only access to the system, it has some hidden counterfactual things
Yeah.
which mm-hmm. might be present outside the system in an actual way.
Yeah.
Somehow, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and that's of course why we can't represent them by the same probability distribution over ontic states, even though they give the same probabilities.
There's a question by Rob.
Were you calling on me?
Yep.
I can hear Emily much better, but I can't hear you very well. I can assume it's...
Yeah, that was a yes.
Okay, great. Thanks for the talk, Emily. I have sort of a comment and then a question. So I just wanted to go over a little bit some of your analysis at the beginning about the sort of various reactions people have had to contextuality. And so your analysis of the sort of Leibnizian angle on it, to my mind, seems to be a kind of dispute about whether one should call, you know, what I've called the Leibnizian methodological principle, quote, Leibniz's principle. And because there's sort of this thing out there, you know, Leibniz's principle, the identity of indiscernibles, it seems to be more to be saying it's not that. And I'm kind of like fine with that. But to some extent, it's the item that came next, which was sort of Einstein's methodological principle. I mean, that's really what the Leibnizian methodological principle is meant to be. And in early papers, I called it Einstein's methodological principle. And I only later said, well, maybe I should give credit to Leibniz. But, you know, ultimately it is the Einstein position. So to some extent, I think your attack on the Leibnizian justification is kind of a straw man attack, because nobody's out there endorsing non-contextuality as following from the thing that you're calling Leibniz's principle. That's just a comment. Now, on the Einstein case, you said, well, the reason this isn't we can't take the kind of response that Einstein took in electrodynamics is because, you know, we're just stuck with contextuality. There's nothing to be done. It's there. But I would say that's not quite right. I mean, we have a no-go theorem. One of the assumptions of that no-go theorem is non-contextuality. Now, that doesn't mean we're stuck with contextuality, because there's all the other assumptions of the no-go theorem that one could hope to abandon. So it's, you know, just like in Einstein's case, if he'd assumed the absolute nature of simultaneity together with the principle of relativity and the light postulate, you know, he would have to be forced to say, oh, well, you know, we get a contradiction. There's nothing to be done. But, you know, there were other, he might be have said, oh, we have to give up the light postulate or something like that. There's nothing to be done. But no, there was other assumptions, like the absolute nature of simultaneity, which were ways out. And so I think, you know, when Marina mentioned the quantum causal models approach, you know, roughly speaking, that's pursuing a different way out of these no-go theorems, which does not avail itself of contextuality. So maybe I should just pause there. I mean, do you agree with, like, in response to Marina's question, you did say that there were these other approaches that you weren't going to discuss, but I mean, you also earlier sort of said that there was kind of only the option of having a contextual model. And so I see a sort of tension between those two statements.
Yes. So I think what I was trying to say about the Einstein case is that in the Einstein case, it sort of seems to have been straightforwardly the case that this feature did not show up anywhere in the empirical data. There was no sort of sense in which the data ever compelled us to have absolute space. That was always a totally separate assumption which we made, but there was no kind of justification for it in the data. Whereas in the contextuality case, it seems to me that it is something about the data itself which causes the problem. So it's not that we can't get rid of contextuality, but it is that it looks to me like contextuality is very much inherent in the phenomena. So it's not a simple case of just invoking Occam's razor and saying, this thing was never actually serving any purpose, let's get rid of it. So I agree, there are certainly routes to pursue to try and make sense of the presence of this feature in the data. But that, I think, is different from simply observing, oh, this was actually never serving any purpose, let's get rid of it. And with respect to the Leibniz example, yeah, I certainly have no problem with just defining some other principle and calling it Leibniz's principle. But my point is more that I think there are sort of reasons I understand why I should think the original Leibniz's principle is true. That's I kind of understand that as something Leibniz is saying about the nature of numerical identity. And my question is just that if we're not dealing with the original Leibniz's principle, what is the reason that I should think this other principle is true? And so some different justification has to be provided for it, different from Leibniz's original one.
Okay, fair enough on the Leibniz case. I would say it's more the historical evidence of the use to which Einstein put it in physics that is one of the reasons we should endorse this kind of principle. And I think I understand now, like, you take Einstein's methodological principle to be a kind of just cutting away of you know, metaphysically unnecessary parts of the theory. And so I think where we differ there is that I think there's much more going on, you know, even in Einstein's work, that, you know, to cut away absolute space from Newtonian mechanics was not just, you know, I declare that it's no longer necessary, let's move on, you know, that there's hard work to be done. So if you want to, you know, move from Newtonian configuration space to a relational configuration space, you need a new way of expressing the dynamical laws, which, you know, we only really understood how to do after Barber and Bertotti came up with a relational formulation of Newtonian mechanics. So I don't see, yeah, I think we sort of see Einstein's methodological principle a little bit differently.
Yeah, well,
go ahead.
Yeah, I see Einstein's methodological principle as primarily an application of Occam's razor, as we don't need this thing, let's get rid of it. Yes, we will have to, you know, rearrange the theory in some ways once we do that, but this kind of structure was never really there in the data to start with. Whereas in the contextuality case, it looks to me like contextuality is much more sort of present in the data.
Okay, if there aren't other people dying to ask questions, I have a different question. Is that okay, or is there somebody? Oh, all right, let me ask it. So it's about Cavalcanti's fine-tuning argument. So in the context of causal explanations of Bell inequality violations, in my paper with Chris Wood, when we said certain models, for example, the models that suppose a cause-effect relation between the labs to explain the Bell inequality violations, when we said those models are fine-tuned, we meant it in a very specific formal way, which is that relative to the classical causal model that you would write down for that particular causal structure, wherein every variable depends on its parents via some conditional probability, and you allow any values for those conditional probabilities, the model is fine-tuned in the sense that the set of values of the conditional probabilities that actually reproduce the no signaling constraint is a set of measure zero relative to all possible values.
Yeah.
So this is Judea Pearl's notion of faithfulness, and that's what we defined as fine-tuning. So what I don't understand about Cavalcanti's argument is it seems to me there's nothing analogous there. There's no sense in which the fine-tuning can be formalized as having to pick out some parameters, which are a set of measure zero in the space of all parameters. So, you know, like, I mean, I could say more, but maybe I should just stop there. That, do you agree that it's a kind of, is it just a kind of qualitative notion of fine-tuning, that it just sort of feels fine-tuned, or is there some more formal notion?
My memory of the paper is that it's very similar to your paper. It uses Pearl's notion in the same kind of way. So in particular, you do have to select parameters in such a way that the dependencies all cancel out when you average over ontic states. So I don't know if, I can't remember if Cavalcanti specifically shows that there are a set of measure zero, but he certainly shows that you do have to very carefully choose those underlying parameters and fine-tune them if you want to get a case where the causal dependencies all vanish during averaging.
Okay, well, so I don't remember the details of it either, but I suspect it's not the case, like you said, very carefully choose, but you know, it could be very carefully in the sense of the ones you have to choose are a set of measure zero of all the ones you could have chosen. But I actually think in this case, that's not what's going on. You have to choose those parameters. They can't be arbitrary. But the set of parameters that will do it for you are not a set of measure zero. They're actually full volume in the space of all those parameters. So to me, it feels very different.
Yeah, so I think his version of the argument simply observes that uses the causal modeling sense in that we have a statistical independence which is not reflected in an underlying but the variables are statistically independent but are connected in the underlying causal graph. So I don't know if he goes specifically into the volume of the set of parameters that will solve this, but he uses just that original causal modeling definition in terms of the mismatch between the statistical independencies and the underlying graph.
So it sounds to me like, therefore, that the intuition for why fine-tuning would be bad must be different from Pearl's intuition. That, you know, like Pearl's intuition is that if the set of things that could possibly explain what I've seen, you know, relative to my model class is a set of measure zero, then it's a really bad explanation. I think that's the same intuition that goes into fine-tuning arguments in cosmology and other places in physics, which is that if it really is a set of measure zero, that's a bad explanation. But it sounds to me like you're saying, no, the notion of fine-tuning here is not about...
It does use the...
For a different reason. Yeah.
The definition he uses is taken straight from Pearl, but I don't think it's at measure zero one. It's just the having causal connections which are not reflected in the statistical dependencies.
But that's not Pearl's definition. Pearl's definition is definitely, I mean, he uses the word faithfulness, not
yes.
Fine-tuning, but it is, the measure zero aspect of it is critical.
I'd have to look back at Cavalcanti's paper because I don't remember if he discusses that aspect. He does do it in terms of faithfulness, definitely, but he defines faithfulness, as far as I can remember, as do the statistical independencies match the underlying causal graph? And he says it's not faithful if you have a statistical independence which is not reflected in the underlying graph.
Okay, I think that answers my questions. Thank you.
There's a question by Yili.
Mm-hmm. Hello. My both questions are... is related to what Rob is talking about. So this difference between the fine-tuning notion used by Rob and by Cavalcanti, is it that the notion you are using is the one exactly used by Cavalcanti? So you are not talking about this measure zero thing?
No, I just used it in terms of the mismatch between statistical independence and the structure of the underlying causal graph. That I guess a weaker definition of faithfulness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the second one is I'm still a bit confused about what exact constraint you are using to remove this fine tuning. So, from what I understood, is that you have this global constraint saying that we cannot have causal loops. Is it a constraint?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or did I misunderstand something? And when you say we cannot have, did you say something?
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry. When you say we cannot have causal loops, are you also saying that we cannot have, say, reciprocal relation between two variables?
Yeah, I'm in favor of reciprocal relations between variables, but those reciprocal relations need to be organized in a way that they don't give rise to logical paradoxes. So they have to be chained together. Variables at the observable level have to be chained together in such a way that we can't make these kinds of loops which would give rise to paradoxes.
So you're saying that if we have reciprocal relations, then we cannot decompose to some sort of loops. Make
sure
you're fine. So, is it the case?
Mm-hmm. So, the relations that are used in these diagrams are, for example, sending a perfect message or a perfect signal. So, in a sense, a perfect message or signal is perfectly symmetrical, right? Just the input is equal to the output. There's no directionality there if you don't want there to be directionality. But you can still require that at the observable level, all these reciprocal processes have to be chained together in a consistent way that avoids giving rise to paradoxes. So they have to be chained together in an acyclic way, but the relations themselves don't have to be directed. They just have to, you can think of it as being a directed acyclic graph, which can be understood as going in either direction. It doesn't matter. But you do have to have, at this observable level, you have to avoid having possible loops in which values have more than one variable.
I see. So this constraint is on what we can see at the observable level, that we should not have any loops, not yes. Ontological level. That okay.
Yeah, it's a constraint essentially on the way that we as agents can chain processes together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thanks for the clarification.
Any other questions?
Actually, I think this might be a kind of follow-up to Eli's question. Mm-hmm. So the teleological explanation.
Yeah.
You said at one point that you could just take, once you accept the idea that you can impose constraints mm-hmm. like, all at once to the universe, then you could just take that to be a constraint. But the concern that you had was about it being seeming arbitrary, right? That
yeah.
you would need to give some sort of explanation for that.
Yeah.
And then this is what you're just talking about. But I'm wondering if that's necessary, like once you think about being able to impose all at once constraints,
yes.
if then you're working in some sort of like landscape of possible theories, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Could part of the idea be, okay, so could we just go and, like if you put this in an operational framework, could we just go and see in the space of theories, what other properties is this theory going to have in particular? Would there be maybe like signaling that could be done, or there might be
yeah.
things that you could do, like observations you could make that we don't observe in our universe.
Mm-hmm.
And you could maybe narrow down your space of theories in that way.
Yeah, definitely. My concern there is just that, you know, if I allow myself to explain things by saying, by a teleological argument saying that I require that this process will turn out in this way, then you can kind of explain anything at all that way, and that looks too easy. So you do have to sort of have some kind of restrictions on what explanations you will accept as good explanations in this space. So one way would be to do as you're suggested and try and see, does this constraint lead to other problems? Is it consistent with all our observations in different ways? Another approach is what I used here, was try to derive it from some kind of deeper underlying constraint, which we can kind of understand the reasons for, and which kind of unifies more than one thing. So this closed loop idea kind of unifies contextuality with signaling in this sense. That's not necessarily the only way we could arrive at good explanations in this space. I just think it's important to make sure, you know, to be clear that not every possible teleological constraint is acceptable as a good explanation in this kind of setting.
I was also thinking about the exchange you had with Rob, and
mm-hmm.
Thinking about non-contextuality being in the data somehow.
Yeah.
And that suggests more maybe like empirical
yeah.
mm-hmm. constraint rather than something that's more, I mean, it could be also have a deeper explanation. Like it could just be a brute empirical constraint that could just turn out like that.
Yeah, definitely. You could just observe that this is the case. But yeah, just the concern is that if you're kind of too loose about what constraints you let yourself impose, then anything is explicable that way with no thought at all. Then you don't want it to be too easy in that sense.
There's a question by
If there's time, I'd like to ask. I'm beginning to learn contextuality, so this is a very basic question. I wonder how you understand the choice of settings for the measurements, the freedom of choice for measurement settings. Do you, when you study contextuality, do you assume these as genuinely free choices, or is it something that's just use a word and the freedom is really not there? Please.
Typically, one takes the measurement setting choice as being a free variable not in the sense that it's emerging magically from nowhere, but in the sense that we suppose it's not correlated with any of the other stuff in the process. So you take it as kind of an input which isn't fixed by anything else. And obviously there are approaches which deny that. So superdeterminism, for example, tells us that measurement choices are not always free in the sense, and we're not free to make all the choices that we like. For various reasons, I don't find superdeterminism all that appealing, but it is an option, and that would perhaps be another way of explaining this kind of contextuality results. As I say, my list of possibilities was not intended to be exhaustive in any sense.
But suppose we don't consider superdeterminism, we just consider determinism.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
In this case, would you say that there are free choices? Now, I'm assuming the Newtonian mechanics kind of determinism.
Yeah.
There's a dynamical law that fixes for you.
Yeah.
If you're given the initial condition.
Yeah, so I don't...
Free choice in this case.
I don't believe in free will at all. But yeah, the term free choice here is just meant to mean that the variables can be treated as inputs which are not determined by anything else or any other choices made elsewhere. So they're not free in the sense of being uncorrelated with anything anywhere in the universe or having no cause. They're just free in the sense that they're not kind of related to the other stuff that's going on in the process. So I don't think you don't have to adopt a really strong sort of metaphysical notion of freedom here to make sense of that.
Okay, thank you.
I think there might be another question by Yile.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I have a follow-up question on what I asked before about the constraint. So from our discussion before, I understood that, okay, it's a constraint only at the level like how agents may influence each other. And we do not actually constrain what's going on underlying that. So in this case, it sounds like by solving one type of fine-tuning that is related to contextuality, we introduce another type of fine-tuning that is in ontological level, we may have some loops, but at the agent level, we cannot have any loops. So it's like, so, yeah.
So the point of the constraint is precisely to constrain the observable data and explain why it is the way that it is. So the fine tuning it explains the fine tuning in the sense that the parameters that go into the model are then to be regarded kind of as outputs rather than inputs, and because the all at once distribution is required to be chosen in such a way as to obey the teleological constraint. So the issue, as I see it, is not the mismatch between the statistics and the underlying stuff. It's explaining that mismatch, and the constraint explains why that mismatch has to occur.
Okay, cool, thanks.
It's going back to the question about Leibniz principle and maybe not Leibniz. So you... as you and Rob were discussing, like Leibniz principle, like the way Leibniz posed it, it's like two things that are numerically the same, so they could be really one and the same, like the two universes or something.
Yeah.
But if like I prepare a qubit and you prepare a qubit and we make the same experiments, it's not a, like there's no way they could be exactly one and the same because.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, in the case you assume this other principle that's not Leibniz principle is also like reasonable and valid. I don't know. Yeah, my question is just like, how do we choose what are the relevant qualities of the system? So why is like all measurements of spin on the qubit valid, but not like the measurement of who prepared it?
That's kind of the point I'm trying to make, that I understand why I should believe Leibniz's principle, because if there's really no distinguishability at all, then it does make sense to me that why should we distinguish between them. The other principle that's going on in the contextuality case, I have no problem with defining another kind of principle and using it in this case, but I do kind of want to know specifically what it is, what kind of differences are relevant and which kind of differences are not relevant, and why I should believe this principle at all. The point I'm making is just that the reasons to believe that are not the same as the reasons to believe Leibniz's principle, so some other kind of argument is needed for it.
Yeah, I can see that. I think it's more of a question like if you do agree with it, or maybe it's a
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind calling it Leibniz's principle if we want to, but I want to know like more in more detail what it is and why I should believe it.
There's another question by Rob, actually.
So this actually goes back to Yile's question, but if we want, we could always come back to it, to what Marina just asked. So I just wanted to get clear. So I thought Yile's question was interesting. So you grant that there is a mismatch between there being a loop at the ontological level, but there not being any loop at the operational level. And you said that the sort of challenge is to kind of explain the mismatch. And so I'm just curious why the response that you gave to the Cavalcanti type of fine tuning was not the same, that, the challenge here is to explain the mismatch between the ontological dependence and the operational independence. And as long as we can explain that mismatch, everything is fine. So, could you just comment on, is it just that you don't see an easy way of explaining the mismatch in that case, whereas you do see a way of explaining it in the other, or am I missing something?
Well, I saw what I did as an attempt to explain that mismatch. So the suggestion that I made is that this kind of constraint, this ruling out of loops at the operational level, explains that mismatch. I do definitely see that as an attempt to explain the mismatch. That's the idea.
But and if somebody came along that had a different explanation of the mismatch that didn't appeal to loops, that's fair game too.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm open to all explanations. Definitely. Just one idea.
But then the loops don't give you another mismatch that you'd also have to explain. I don't understand the answer. Sorry.
So I think Rob's question was about the problem with contextuality is essentially how do we explain this mismatch between the operational stuff and the underlying stuff, and my proposal was to explain it by saying that we have this teleological constraint which rules out loops at the operational level and therefore requires that Gleason's property is satisfied. There are other possible explanations. I don't claim that's the one and true explanation. That's I think I find this interesting because it's an example of how this kind of teleological reasoning might work, and I see possibilities for this kind of teleological argument to be used more widely in physics. So this is just kind of an example of how that kind of reasoning could go.
Well, to finish up, let me briefly come back to the question you asked just a moment ago. If it's not, Leibniz's metaphysical principle we're talking about, then what justifies it? So let's call it the Leibniz-Einstein methodological principle. It's exactly what Einstein used. So if you say, well, what justifies it? To my mind, the answer is not here's some metaphysical justification such that it's, you have to endorse this, but rather it's one that says, well, how do we ever know what are the right principles to use in physics? We can't, we try to get by, but we can look at, historical success. And, in my paper, I argued that Einstein made three uses of this methodological principle, and they were the foundation on which he built special and general relativity. So that the greatest, conceptual revolutions in physics are based on this principle. What more of an endorsement could you ask for? I mean, that's my answer. It's the historical merit of the principle.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good argument. It's still a little bit unclear why some differences are relevant and other differences are not relevant. I think the principle needs perhaps specification in certain ways as to tell us why the probability distributions are the only thing that matter and other things don't matter.
So suppose I asked you the same question about Einstein's use of the equivalence principle. You could say, well, but hang on a second. It's not the case that every experiment I do in the lift can't tell them apart, because if I open the window and I look out and I see, oh, I'm in space, I'm not sitting on a planet there. I've sorted it out. So, you know, Einstein's principle is not well defined.
Sure. And I'm not saying we shouldn't use this principle. I'm just saying that to use this principle well, it would be nice to kind of clarify some of these intuitions about what differences matter and which ones don't.
So you're saying that same clarificatory work is also needs to be done for Einstein's equivalence principle. That you know, it's an open problem in general relativity as well to clarify what Einstein's equivalence principle really is.
Yeah, absolutely. Einstein's equivalence principle is a huge mess, to be honest. There's at least four or five different versions of it.